Welcome back to A Year of War and Peace, the podcast where we go from War and Peace Zero to War and Peace Hero in 1 year flat. We are now up to book four, page 233 of Leo Tolstoy's War and Peace. I think that's a pretty good milestone worth celebrating. Well done, us. Let's jump into chapter one of book four and see what the gang are up to. Early in the year 1806, Nicholas Rostov returned home on leave. Denisov was going home to Voronezh, and Rostov persuaded him to travel with him as far as Moscow, and to stay with him there. Meeting a comrade at the last post station, but one before Moscow, Denisov had drunk three bottles of wine with him, and despite the jolting ruts across the snow-covered road, did not once wake up on the way to Moscow, but lay at the bottom of the sledge beside Rostov, who grew more and more impatient the nearer they got to Moscow. How much longer? How much longer? Oh, these insufferable streets, shops, bakers' signboards, street lamps and sledges, thought Rostov, when their leave permits had been passed at the town gate and they had entered Moscow. Denisov were here. He's asleep, he added, leaning forward with his whole body, as if in that position he hoped to hasten the speed of the sledge. Denisov gave no answer. There's the corner at the crossroads, where the cabman Zakhar has his stand, and there's Zakhar himself, and still the same horse. And here's the little shop where we used to buy gingerbread. Can't you hurry up? Now then. Which house is it? Asked the driver. Why, that one right at the end, the big one, don't you see? That's our house, said Rostov. Of course it's our house. Denisov, we're almost there. Denisov raised his head, coughed, and made no answer. Dmitri, said Rostov to his valet on the box, those lights are in our house, aren't they?
Yes, sir, and there's a light in your father's study.
Then they've not gone to bed yet. What do you think? Mind now, don't forget to put out my new coat, added Rostov, fingering his new moustache. Now then, get on, he shouted to the driver. Do wake up, Vaska, he went on, turning to Denisov, whose head was again nodding. Come, get on. You shall have 3 rubles for vodka. Get on, Rostov shouted when the sledge was only 3 houses from his door. It seemed to him the horses were not moving at all. At last, the sledge bore to the right, drew up at an entrance, and Rostov saw overhead the old familiar cornice with a bit of plaster broken off, the porch and the post by the side of the pavement. He sprang out before the sledge stopped and ran into the hall. The house stood cold and silent, as if quite regardless of who had come to it. There was no one in the hall. Oh God, is everyone all right? He thought, stopping for a moment with a sinking heart, and then immediately starting to run along the hall and up the warped steps of the familiar staircase. The well-known old door handle, which always angered the Countess when it was not properly cleaned, turned as loosely as ever. A solitary tallow candle burnt in the anteroom. Old Michael was asleep on the chest. Prokofy, the footman, who was so strong that he could lift the back of the carriage from behind, sat plaiting slippers out of cloth selvages. He looked up at the opening, and his expression of sleepy indifference suddenly changed to one of delighted amazement. "Gracious heavens, the young Count!" he cried, recognizing his young master. "Can it be my treasure?" And Prokofy, trembling with excitement, rushed towards the drawing-room door, probably in order to announce him, but, changing his mind, came back and stooped to kiss the young man's shoulder. "All well?" asked Rostov, drawing away his arm. "Yes, God be thanked, yes, they've just finished supper. Let me have a look at you, Your Excellency." "Is everything quite all right?" "The Lord be thanked, yes." Rostov, who had completely forgotten Denisov, not wishing anyone to forestall him, threw off his fur coat and ran on tiptoe through the large dark ballroom. All was the same. There were the same old card tables and the same chandelier with a cover over it, but someone had already seen the young master, and before he had reached the drawing room something flew out from a side door like a tornado and began hugging and kissing him. Another, and yet another creature of the same kind,
sprang from a second door and a third, more hugging, more kissing, more outcries, and tears of joy. He could not distinguish which was Papa, which Natasha, and which Petya. Everyone shouted, talked, and kissed him at the same time. Only his mother was not there, he noticed that. "And I did not know, Nicholas, my darling. Here he is, our own. Kolya, dear fellow, how he has changed. Where are the candles, tea? And me, kiss me. Dearest, and me." Sonya, Natasha, Petya, Anna Mikhailovna, Vera, and the old count were all hugging him, and the serfs, men and maids, flocked into the room, exclaiming and ooing and ahhing. Petya, clinging to his legs, kept shouting, "And me too!" Natasha, after she had pulled him down towards her and covered his face with kisses, holding him tight by the skirt of his coat, sprang away and pranced up and down in one place like a goat, and shrieked piercingly. All around were loving eyes glistening with tears of joy, and all around were lips seeking a kiss. Sonya too, all rosy red, clung to his arm, and radiant with bliss, looked eagerly towards his eyes, waiting for the look for which she longed. Sonya now was 16, and she was very pretty, especially at this moment of happy, rapturous excitement. She gazed at him, not taking her eyes off him, and smiling and holding her breath. He gave her a grateful look, but was still expectant and looking for someone. The old countess had not yet come. But now steps were heard at the door, steps so rapid that they could hardly be his mother's. Yet it was she, dressed in a new gown, which he did not know, made since he had left. All the others let him go, and he ran to her. When they met, she fell on his breast, sobbing. She could not lift her face, but only pressed it to the cold braiding of his hussar's jacket. Denisov, who had come into the room unnoticed by anyone, stood there and wiped his eyes at the sight. "Vasily Denisov, your son's friend," he said, introducing himself to the count, who was looking inquiringly at him. "You are most welcome, I know," said the count, kissing and embracing Denisov. "Nicholas wrote us. Natasha, Vera, look, here is Denisov." The same happy, rapturous faces turned to the shaggy figure of Denisov. "Darling Denisov," screamed Natasha, beside herself with rapture, springing to him, putting her arms around him and kissing him. This escapade made everybody feel confused. Denisov blushed too, but smiled, and taking Natasha's hand, kissed it. Denisov was shown to the room prepared for him, and the Rostovs all gathered round Nicholas in the sitting room. The old countess, not letting go of his hand and kissing it every moment, sat beside him, the rest crowding round him, watched every movement, word, or look of his, never taking their blissful, adoring eyes off him. His brothers and sisters struggled for the places nearest to him and disputed with one another who should bring him his tea, handkerchief, and pipe. Rostov was very happy in the love they showed him, but the first moment of meeting had been so beatific that his present joy seemed insufficient, and he kept expecting something more, more, and yet more. Next morning, after the fatigues of their journey, the travellers slept till 10 o'clock. In the room next, their bedroom, there was a confusion of sabres, satchels, sabretaches, open portmanteau, and dirty boots. Two freshly cleaned pairs with spurs had just been placed by the wall. The servants were bringing in jugs and basins, hot water for shaving, and their well-brushed clothes. There was a masculine odour and a smell of tobacco. "Hello, Gwishka, my pipe," came Vasily Denisov's husky voice. "Rostov, get up." Rostov, rubbing his eyes that seemed glued together, raised his dishevelled head from the hot pillow. "Why, is it late?" "Late? It's nearly 10 o'clock, answered Natasha's voice. A rustle of starched petticoats and the whispering and laughter of girls' voices came from the adjoining room. The door was opened a crack, and there was a glimpse of something blue, of ribbons, black hair, and merry faces. It was Natasha, Sonya, and Petya, who had come to see whether they were getting up. "Nicholas, get up," Natasha's voice was again heard at the door. "Directly." Meanwhile, Petya, having found and seized the sabres in the outer room, with the delight boys feel at the sight of a military elder brother, and forgetting that it was unbecoming for the girls to see men undressed, opened the bedroom door. "Is this your sabre?" he shouted. The girls sprang aside. Denisov hid his hairy legs under the blanket, looking with a scared face at his comrade for help. The door, having let Petya in, closed again. A sound of laughter came from behind it. "Nicholas, come out in your dressing gown," said Natasha's voice. "Is this your sabre?" asked Petya. "Or is it yours?" he said, addressing the black-moustached Denisov with servile deference. Rostov hurriedly put something on his feet, drew on his dressing gown, and went out. Natasha had put on one spurred boot and was just getting her foot into the other. Sonya, when he came in, was twirling round and was about to expand her dress into a balloon and sit down. They were dressed alike in new pale blue frocks and were both fresh, rosy and bright. Sonya ran away, but Natasha, taking her brother's arm, led him into the sitting room where they began talking. They hardly gave one another time to ask questions and give replies concerning a thousand little matters which could not interest anyone but themselves. Natasha laughed at every word he said, or that she said herself, not because what they were saying was amusing, but because she felt happy and was unable to control her joy, which expressed itself by laughter. "Oh, how nice, how splendid," she said to everything. Rostov felt that under the influence of the warm rays of love, that childlike smile, which had not once appeared on his face since he left home, now for the first time after 18 months, again brightened his soul and his face. "No, but listen," she said. "Now, you are quite a man, aren't you? I'm awfully glad you're my brother." She touched his moustache. "I want to know what you men are like. Are you the same as we? No." "Why did Sonya run away?" asked Rostov. "Ah, yes. That's a whole long story. How are you going to speak to her? Thou or you?" The footnote here says that in Russian, as in other foreign languages, the second person singular is used in addressing children and intimates, and the second person plural in addressing those with whom one is more formal. "As may happen," said Rostov. "No, call her you, please. I'll tell you all about it some other time. No, I'll tell you now. You know, Sonya's my dearest friend, such a friend that I burnt my arm for her sake. Look here." She pulled up her muslin sleeve and showed him a red scar on her long, slender, delicate arm, high above the elbow, on the part that is covered even by a ball dress. "I burnt this to prove my love for her. I just heated a ruler in the fire and pressed it there." Sitting on the sofa with the little cushions on its arms, in what used to be his old schoolroom, and looking into Natasha's wildly bright eyes, Rostov re-entered that world of home and childhood which had no meaning for anyone else, but gave him some sort of the best joys of his life. And the burning of an arm with a ruler as a proof of love did not seem to him senseless. He understood, and was not surprised at it. "Well, and is that all?" he asked. "We are such friends. Such friends. All that ruler business was just nonsense. But we are friends forever. She, if she loves anyone, does it for life. But I don't understand that. I forget quickly." "Well, what then?" "Well, she loves me and you like that." Natasha suddenly flushed. "Why, you remember before you went away. Well, she says you are to forget all that. She says I shall love him always, but let him be free. Isn't that lovely and noble?" "Yes, very noble. Isn't it?" asked Natasha, so seriously and excitedly that it was evident that she was now saying she had talked of before with tears. Rostov became thoughtful. "I never go back on my word," he said. "Besides, Sonya is so charming that only a fool would renounce such happiness." "No, no," cried Natasha. "She and I have already talked it over. We knew you'd say so. But it won't do, because you see, if you say that, if you consider yourself bound by your promise, It will seem as if she had not meant it seriously. It makes it as if you were marrying her because you must, and that wouldn't do at all." Rostov saw that it had been well considered by them. Sonya had already struck him by her beauty on the preceding day. Today, when he caught a glimpse of her, she seemed still more lovely. She was a charming girl of 16, evidently passionately in love with him. He did not doubt that for an instant. Why should he not love her now, and even marry her, Rostov thought. But just now there were so many other pleasures and interests before him. Yes, they have taken a wise decision, he thought. I must remain free. Well then, that's excellent, said he. We'll talk it over later on. Oh, how glad I am to have you. Well, are you still true to Boris? He continued. Oh, what nonsense, cried Natasha, laughing. I don't think about him or anyone else, and I don't want anything of the kind. Dear me, then what are you up to now? Now, repeated Natasha, and a happy smile lit up her face. Have you seen Duport? No. Not seen Duport, the famous dancer? Well, then you won't understand. That's what I'm up to. Curving her arms, Natasha held out her skirt, as dancers do, ran back a few steps, turned, cut a caper, brought her little feet sharply together, and made some steps on the very tips of her toes. See, I'm standing, see? She said, but could not maintain herself on her toes any longer. So that's what I'm up to. I'll never marry anyone, but will be a dancer. Only don't tell anyone. Rostov laughed so loud and merrily that Denisov in his bedroom felt envious, and Natasha could not help joining in. No, but don't you think it's nice? She kept repeating. Nice? And so you no longer wish to marry Boris? Natasha flared up. I don't want to marry anyone, and I'll tell him when I see him. Dear me, said Rostov. But that's all rubbish, Natasha chattered on. And is Denisov nice? She asked. Yes, indeed. Oh, well then, goodbye, go and dress. Is he very terrible, Denisov? Why terrible? Asked Nicholas. No, Vaska is a splendid fellow. You call him Vaska? That's funny. And he is very nice. Very. Well then, be quick. We'll all have breakfast together. And Natasha rose and went out of the room on tiptoe like a ballet dancer, but smiling as only happy girls of 15 can smile. When Rostov met Sonya in the drawing room, he reddened. He did not know how to behave with her. The evening before, in the first happy moment of meeting, they had kissed each other, but today they felt it could not be done. He felt that everybody, including his mother and sisters, was looking inquiringly at him and watching to see how he would behave with her. He kissed her hand and addressed her not as thou, but as you, Sonya. But their eyes met and said thou, and exchanged tender kisses. Her looks asked him to forgive her for having dared, by Natasha's intermediacy, to remind him of his promise, and then thanked him for his love. His looks thanked her for offering him his freedom, and told her that, one way or another, he would never cease to love her, for that would be impossible. How strange it is, said Vera, selecting a moment when all were silent, that Sonya and Nicholas now say you to one another, and meet like strangers. Vera's remark was correct, as her remarks always were. But, like most of her observations, it made everyone feel uncomfortable. Not only Sonya, Nicholas and Natasha, but even the old countess, who, dreading this love affair might hinder Nicholas from making a brilliant match, blushed like a girl. Denisov, to Rostov's surprise, appeared in the drawing room with a pomaded hair, perfumed and in a new uniform, looking just as smart as he made himself when going into battle. And he was more amiable to the ladies and gentlemen than Rostov had ever expected to see him. All right, there we have it, another chapter down. And what a dramatic shift in tone from the previous chapter. The last chapter of book 3 and the first chapter of book 4. Just chalk and cheese, really, weren't they? Now, I'm calling this book 4, chapter 1 of book 4, but in all the different translations and editions of this book, they are split up differently. So some editions have book 1, part 1, chapter 1, whereas this is just split up into books and chapters. So in other versions of the book, you might be thinking this is chapter 1 of part 1 of book 2. If this isn't confusing enough. Whereas in the Maud Wordsworth Classics edition that I'm reading, this is what they call book 4. That probably made no sense whatsoever. It doesn't really matter. To be honest, the chapters are the same. It's just the way they've split them up and how they've assigned numbers to them. So we've jumped ahead a little bit here as we go into book 4. It's the next year, and Nikolai has returned back to Russia, which I think is pretty cool. I didn't expect that to happen. I kind of thought that the time scale of the book would move a lot slower. In my head, I was picturing that Nikolai would remain at the war, or the characters who have gone to war, sorry, would remain there until the end of the novel, or until, you know, they died or whatever happens to them. I didn't think that once they'd gone, they'd come back so early in the book. Overall, I liked this chapter. It was nice, you know, it gave me that kind of warm, fuzzy feeling that the family was so happy to see him, and also that they were so happy to see his new friend, Denisov. They kind of embrace him and kiss him and welcome him as if he's one of their family, which I kind of thought, oh, that's nice. I don't know why, but that just really kind of struck me as pleasant. I was especially interested to see Natasha kind of all over the shop with her enthusiasm for Rostov, for her brother Nikolai to be home, and for this new guest, Denisov, to be there. And also I liked seeing Rostov's new take on his relationship with Sonya. There's the point in the chapter where Natasha takes him aside and asks him, is he going to honour his promise that he made to Sonya before he went to war? And actually she's hoping that he doesn't want to marry her just because of the promise. Essentially, she says, we want you not to honour the promise, but we do want you guys to end up together. Or essentially, we want you guys to be together because you want to be, not because you made a promise a year ago. From what I felt from the chapter, he sort of feels a bit mixed about Sonya. He's underwhelmed by everything. There's the passage where it says, his present happiness seemed too little to him, and he kept waiting for more and more and more. Reddit user Mellow Yellow said, I'm sure Rostov loves Sonya, but wants more. He wants a love where he would burn his arm with a heated ruler, as an expression of it, as Natasha did. Which, by the way, Natasha, what the F? My take on that underwhelmingness of being home, you know, he's being smothered with love and kisses and everyone's so thrilled he's home and he's happy, but he just keeps feeling like there should be more. He should be feeling more. I think he's comparing it to that completely absorbed feeling of rapture that he was feeling towards his emperor. You know, he marched across, or he rode his horse through the most dangerous part of the battle just to deliver a message to his emperor, who he would have happily died before. He was just completely, completely in love with this emperor. And then seeing the emperor, was so terrified to speak to him because of that love that he chickened out. And now I guess he's comparing that feeling to what he feels with Sonya. And he's not feeling the same thing to Sonya. He's not feeling that overwhelming sense of awe for this person. He's experienced these heightened emotions, which I guess you just can't replicate in civil society. What you feel out there at a war, in a war situation, is just completely heightened senses in every way. You know, no matter how engaging a situation is when you're home in civilized company, it's never going to be as engaging as when you're sprinting across a battlefield, or, you know, talking to military leaders that you worship and these kinds of things. Reddit user Alicili said, there's an interesting juxtaposition here. The excitement of a battlefield in the previous book versus the happier excitement of a homecoming. Both evoke a feeling of intensely frantic expectation and confusion, one of terror and the other of delight. Yeah, true, but, you know, he seemed pretty delighted out there on the battlefield quite a lot of the time, even in his terror. That was something that was reiterated quite a lot of times in the last few, or the last 20 or so chapters in the war section, is that the soldiers felt really happy to be running out into the battlefield, strangely enough. Ali Silly continues to say, Natasha is really a whirlwind, isn't she? She and Sonya act much more like 12 or 13-year-olds than 15-year-olds, I think. The burning seemed more like an intense tween action, as does Sonya's spinning and ballooning of her dress. I keep reading Sonya and Nicholas's two kids who had crushes on each other, mostly due to societal constraints, so I just keep rolling my eyes at their love and devotion. I can't tell if Tolstoy is equally rolling his eyes, though in comparison, I can tell when reading Jane Austen, for example, when teen characters are meant to be utterly ridiculous. Reddit user Quitterset responded, I don't get the sense that he's intentionally painting them as utterly ridiculous. In the context of 19th century Russian literature, this doesn't read like, say, a Lydia Bennett type of ridiculousness. It definitely reads to me like he's intending to portray fairly normal-ish teenage reactions under these particular circumstances, where teenager is inherently a little bit over the top and uncertain in one moment while madly in love in the next. There was the line where Rostov said, why shouldn't he, Rostov, love her, Sonya, and even marry her? And it's kind of, might seem a bit like he's indifferent to the idea, like, I can't see any reason not to, which might be what they're getting across there, but I again read it as that even the concept of falling in love and getting married and having a good marriage just doesn't compare to what he's experienced in war in terms of how engaging it is and you know, what emotions he's feeling about it. Everything's a bit dulled and maybe numbed. It might even seem that, you know, things that are going on back in civilized society seem trivial to him, which I think is quite understandable coming back from something like a war. Reddit user Quitterset is reading this book in both Russian, the original version, and the Moore translation, which is what we're reading as well on the podcast. Quitterset is talking about the part where Rostov and Natasha are discussing how Rostov should address Sonya when he speaks to her. The passage goes like this. Why did Sonya run away? Asked Rostov. Yes, that's a whole long story. How are you going to speak to her, thou or you? As may happen, said Rostov. No, call her you, please. I'll tell you all about it some other time. And then later, Rostov meets Sonya, and the passage goes like this. He kissed her hand and addressed her not as thou, but as you, Sonya. But their eyes met and said thou, and exchanged tender kisses. So the difference here, as explained by Quitterset, I won't read Quitterset's explanation because it's got a lot of Russian words in it which I don't know how to pronounce or anything like that. But essentially, one of the words translates roughly to you, and that's what a sort of a close, very close friend or someone who's family, you'd refer to them as that. Whereas the translation that comes across as thou puts some linguistic distance between them. As Quitterset puts it. So it's a less affectionate way to address her. Basically, if he chooses to say you rather than thou, he's showing to Sonya and everyone who is within earshot that his affection for her has grown since they've been apart. And so he tries it on and he says you, but then there's a look in his eyes that sort of speaks louder than words, so to speak, and shows everyone that he feels a bit awkward. In the Briggs translation, they use the French tu, which is informal, versus the vous, which is formal. And in the P&V translation, Natasha asks if he's going to address Sonya as miss or not. It seems to me that particular little quirk of Russian language has been difficult to translate into English. And all three English translations that, well, the three main ones, I should say, Briggs, Maud, and PNV, have all opted for completely different ways to try to convey that same message there. So there we go. One thing I am excited about is that we've fast-forwarded. I'm not sure exactly how long we've fast-forwarded, but we're in the next year. That means we get to see the fate of Prince Andrew. We don't have to wait and see if he recovers. We're going to probably find out that he has either recovered or not. It's another chapter that's left me keen for the next one, so that's a good thing. Another thing I should mention is that Reddit user Brian E. Denton, who has the Medium page, A Year of War and Peace, he's the absolute War and Peace expert. He is going to be a guest on the podcast in the next couple of episodes. I'm not sure if it's going to be in tomorrow's episode or maybe the next one. It'll be within the next few, though. I'm going to do a little interview with Brian, which is going to be pretty exciting. So that's something to look forward to. For now, thank you very much for listening, and I will see you tomorrow.